Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rich Singeri. For such a wee state, Vermont has a really good number of Olympic athletes, but that's usually in the winter variety of the Olympics. In the Summer Olympics, not so much. We've had some outstanding rowers make it, like Judy Gear at the 76 Olympics in Montreal. Her sister Carly rowed in L.A. in 84. Serena Eddy Moulton competed at the Barcelona Games in 1992. This year in Tokyo, we have a bright young star in Ellie Perrier-St-Pierre running the 1,500 meters. She qualified this week in stellar fashion, setting a U.S. Olympic trials record of 3 minutes, 58.3 seconds. And she made it look really easy. For the past couple of years, as sports editor of the St. Albans Messenger, Ruthie LaRush has been following the exploits of this Richford High School and UNH grad as she made her mark in international middle distance running. Ruthie, she joins us now to tell us about this superstar from Montgomery. Welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Rick, it is a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. Now, listeners, if you want to ask Ruthie a question or if you want to share a story about Ellie, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Ruthie, give us a little background on who Ellie Perrier-St-Pierre is.
Well, you know, Ellie was a standout high school runner, but she actually didn't really start running until high school. A man named Richard Flint, who was coaching, I think, JV basketball, saw her running and thought she would be a great cross-country runner and encouraged her to come out and give it a shot. And she did. And it did not take long before she was, she was setting herself apart as an outstanding Vermont athlete. And actually, both Richard and Ellie have told me a story, which if you're anybody that has lived near the border, it will resonate with you that, he could not keep up with her. So he would drive his truck behind her when they went out to do a long run. And on more than one occasion, the Border Patrol pulled him over to the side of the road to find out why he was following this young girl running these backcountry roads up here in Franklin County. And he said, and as did she, that she wouldn't stop running. She would just keep going while he was getting questioned by the Border Patrol.
They couldn't confirm his story.
that's the start of this Olympic greatness.
Wow, to think... an assistant or a JV basketball coach, if he doesn't spot her, doesn't make the effort to get her to run competitively, how different it would be. When did you first interview or meet Ellie?
My first phone interview with her was last spring, shortly after the Olympics had been postponed. And I reached out to her. I had spoken with her, with her mom and with her fiance then, Jamie, and Richard Flint, and her, her college coach. And I finally got in touch with her to ask her if she would be willing to speak some encouraging words to the high school, especially the high school athletes in these five schools that I cover. And she did not even hesitate. She was happy to do it. You're not going to find a more kind and humble, but also, really mature and grounded person. Mm-hmm. And I had mentioned to you, Rick, the other day that, one of the phrases that she spoke that really stuck with me, it was about the Olympics being postponed, was, I can only be frustrated with the things I can control. And, the emphasis was definitely on the can. And that was a profound impact on me to hear somebody that has sacrificed so much, worked so hard, to have that, that Olympic trial taken away. And sure, we'll postpone until next year. Next year's a long way, right?
Yeah.
A lot can happen in a year. So to have that be her attitude, you know, I can only be frustrated about the things I can control. You know, what a beautiful statement to be able to share, you know, with my readership, especially with, you know, high school athletes,
yeah.
You know, who are missing a lot. And I have had the opportunity to share that, you know, with a lot of high school athletes. And it's, you know, and it has had a profound effect on them, you know, which I think speaks to the power that someone like Ellie has to, you know, to impact young people.
Well, Ruthie, there's a few hundred thousand steps between, you know, going out for that high school cross-country team to qualifying for the Olympics. So what are some of the steps along the way and coaches who have helped her as she's matured as an elite middle-distance runner?
You know, I think the best place would be to start with, you know, with her UNH coach, Robert Hoppler. You know, I've gotten to speak with him on a couple occasions, and I am telling you, he's got to be ecstatic right now.
Right.
you know, he loved Ellie. You know, they even, you know, took at least one trip. I won't say more than that, you know, up to, you know, to the Puryear Farm in Montgomery. And, yeah, but he was very... What's the word I want? He was very careful with her to, you know, to really help her mature as an athlete. And I'm sure that's a very tempting thing to do, to push somebody like Ellie, right? And you can see all the potential, you know, and try to rush things.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, talking with Robert, I mean, it was a wonderful choice on Ellie's part to, you know, to pick that UNH program. And he felt, you know, Robert felt the same way about her decision to go and run with, you know, Team New Balance Boston and for, you know, for Mark Coogan, who is an Olympian himself. You know, Robert just did not have, he couldn't say enough about how carefully, you know, Mark and that New Balance team has worked with Ellie to, you know, to not burn her out, physically and emotionally, because, you know, we concentrate on the running, right? And you look at that and think, oh my goodness, you know, that's amazing to be able to do that. But there's definitely, you know, a mental side to this. I mean, you know, runners can be gone for months at a time training. And I'm sure that you know, Rick, that Ellie's family, you know, her parents, her, you know, siblings, her, you know, nieces, nephews. So, you know, just that, you know, and obviously her husband, Jamie, you know, it's a big sacrifice for her to leave that. So, you know, she really got herself into a good position with coaches who have been able to, you know, help her reach incredible milestones, but also have respected her as a person and, you know, respected what makes her happy, which is important.
Yeah, it really is. Hey, let's go to the phones. We've got Dick joining us from Waterbury. Dick, go right ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, good. Say, as Ellie's name began to come up more and more, I actually was able to watch, I think, the last five races she had, the Melrose Games and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I ever see her lose a race, and she always won going away.
Yeah.
But the real concern, of course, in the finals was when she got pushed.
Right.
And I watched it over and over and over again, and that sure did look intentional to me. I mean,
well, so,
my feeling is even if she'd gone down, she still would have won.
Well, Dick, now I see it a little differently, and I could be wrong, and I'd love to hear Ruthie's thoughts on this, so stay on the line, Dick.
Mm-hmm.
But it looked like, you know, especially, you know, in these types of races, and I don't quite understand why everybody in the first, you know, 10 feet think they have to get right to the, to that inside lane when, you know, you've got several laps and, you know, several hundred yards really to kind of let the pack, you know, work out, but it looked like some of the runners from the outside came rushing across the track and bumped into other runners who bumped into Ellie and knocked her off the track. But Ruthie, what did you see in that that Olympic final, trials final?
You know, the first thing that came to my mind, and I hope you will both get a chuckle out of this, or all of you, I was remembering sitting in my driver's ed class in high school, and having the description given about, you know, if you're driving on the interstate and you're in that pack of cars, you know, you want to either fall back or get ahead so that you're not, you don't, you know, because it's kind of a dangerous place to be. So that was the first thing that came to my mind. And I felt like Ellie handled it with so much poise. I mean, I was watching her and watching her face, and I just felt like you could see that that determination kick in. She was not going to go down.
Right.
And, you know, she made her break right there. You know, talking with her mom a couple of years ago, you know, her mom was saying that Ellie's talent has, you know, has been obviously a big reason why she is where she is, but it's her determination that's gotten her there. And I felt like if there was anything that I'd seen over the last couple of years that has exhibited that determination, that was one of those moments.
Yeah.
You know, it, just,
absolutely. Yeah, Dick, go ahead.
In the final recap, though, I didn't see this girl's name listed. So I was wondering, did she perhaps get disqualified?
The one who would have bumped into her.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we'll have to look that up. I don't know. We'll check if Ruthie did. But, Dick, thanks for that. Ruthie, do you know if anyone was disqualified because of what happened at the start of that race?
I did not hear that. I've not heard anything about disqualifying. And actually, I was speaking with a photographer yesterday who was on the scene. He did not mention it, you know, as he was giving his description of the race and the events that took place afterwards. You know, I guess I was just super grateful that, you know, all was well, that ended well there for
right.
Ellie, and that was where I put my focus. But it's a good question, and it would be interesting to find out.
All right, I'll try to look that up on the break. I did notice that Ellie was distracted early on. She did turn back to look at the pack maybe two or three times. But then after that, like you said, Ruthie, that look of determination, that look of, I'm just going to get away from these people as quickly as I can, and I'll show them. And boy, she did. All right. I didn't find anything out about whether anyone had been disqualified from the race, as Dick thought was possible. The one thing I do love, though, Ruthie, is Dick and Waterbury has started to watch these 1,500-meter races of Ellie and is following it now so closely, and watched the start of that race a number of times, probably more than I have. So he might be, you know, right and I'm wrong, but it really is great to see that enthusiasm that our runner here in Montgomery has created for people in this race, as Dick verbalized.
Oh, it's fantastic. I was talking to somebody the other day who owns a daycare, and she was saying, oh, the kids are all out, you know, they're outside, and they're pretending to be Elliot, and somebody's got to be the coach. we see that impact, and I have no doubt, you know, cross-country and track athletes throughout the state, you know, are probably tuning in a little more closely to see how all this is going to go down. Ellie's, you know, she's been so generous with her, you know, with her time with schools and athletes. I was speaking with a man named Michael Nashtier, who has been a longtime proponent of, you know, track and field and, you know, cross country and Nordic skiing, and coaches at BFAC and Albans up here. And, you know, he invited Ellie to come last summer at the end of the summer to, you know, to do a day long camp. With you know, with his runners, and she came out for, you know, she came out, spoke to the group, and when I took a run with them, and, you know, he sent me a picture. There they are, you know, there's Ellie Currier out there with this group of, you know, of Franklin County runners. So that's you know, that's when you know you're dealing with somebody that that really puts their money where their mouth is, right?
Well, yeah. And the other thing is that we should mention, tell us about the dedication of the race to Riley St. Pierre and her parents.
Yes, that that was a tragedy, a true tragedy that took place, I mean, just maybe, what, three weeks before? Mm-hmm. You know, that... If you're up here and you know the St. Pierre family, it's a very tight-knit family. That, you know, the loss of Riley, she was 2 years old, definitely would have left an impact, not just on Ellie, but on, you know, on her husband Jamie and that whole family group. So, tough time. Just one more mental piece, you know, to work through. We can't pick when these things are going to come, right? Whether it's a tragedy or whether it's, you know, one of the probably highlights of Ellie's life thus far. So I thought it was very well spoken, you know, to dedicate that race and, to do it in the way she did.
What is she like as a person?
Oh, she's wonderful. She's a wonderful lady. Very, very thoughtful, very kind, very humble. I had mentioned to you, you know, obviously I've spoken with several people, about the person that she is, and they say the same thing over again. You know, people that don't really have a much of a connection with one another. You know, they talk about, you know, the humility that she has, but at the same time, she's very confident. And a phrase that I love to say to the athletes I have the privilege of interviewing is that, you know, confidence is beautiful. And I would definitely use that to describe Ellie. You know, she does radiate that. And I think it's a wonderful thing to see someone that has that confidence, but at the same time does have that level of humility. You know, there's no, you would not think of her as different than anyone else. You know, she has no airs. She's just a very genuine person. And, my husband and I were out running on the Missisquoi Valley Rail Trail last fall. And, you know, and she was out there with her husband, Jamie. He was loading a bike into his truck, and she was obviously cooling down. And, you know, I waved to her and said hi, and she was, you know, she acted like she was, you know, very glad to see me, and, that's her, just very down-to-earth, and genuine person.
And I did notice, like Dick, I replayed this part of the proceedings from Monday, the post-match or the post-race interview. I did notice a little profanity slip from our local hero. I was a little shocked, but she can't be 100% perfect. But she's carrying the torch for Vermont right now, and it's really great to see her off to Japan for the Olympics. Now, Ruthie, I do want to spend a little more time talking about another athlete you've written about in your area, who is quite remarkable, Cam Dunsmore. Tell us about him.
Cam is definitely a remarkable athlete. He graduated in 2020, so he was one of the athletes that had to get through, you know, the pandemic, or the first kind of first wave of it. But through high school, he played football. He was a kicker for the football team. And obviously he was All-American, selected as All-American for soccer and, basketball player. One of those people that's just so confident, but so humble. Every coach would just speak of, you know, of the way that he interacted with his teammates, always encouraging and, just encouraging them to be their best. He went on to play when he was going to play soccer at the collegiate level. And, this spring decided that he was going to, you know, step away from athletics. He was ready to, you know, to get in, to start living his life, you know, living his adult life. And so, he has plans to, he actually wants to become a farrier. He's going to head out to the University of Montana at the end of the summer. And then his goal is to enlist in the Navy and get into the Navy SEAL training program. And I will tell you, Rick, that if anybody's going to be able to do that, this kid is going to be able to do it. He is in absolutely incredible shape. In March, he completed this 4x4x48. Which basically you run 4 hours, you sleep 4, then you get up, you run 4 more hours, and you do this for 48 hours. Huh. And he was saying it was the hardest thing he's ever done. The weekend that he picked to do it, I think it was a high of 15 and a low of, like, I don't know, 5 or -5.
And Ruthie, you better explain, because I had to look it up. What is a farrier?
So a farrier is someone that, you know, shoes horses, mm-hmm. takes care of horses. He has a passion for that, and he wants to have a long career in the Navy. So the thought was that when you're done, you know, when you retire from that naval career, what are you going to do when you're done? Well, you know, something he wants to do, something that he really enjoys, that he's that he's passionate about. So that'll be that care of horses. But he's got a ways to go, I think, till he gets there if he follows this this plan. But again, another extremely determined person, just outstanding in every way.
Yeah, and to become a Navy SEAL, great goal, but a lot of work to get there. So good luck to Cam Dunsmore on his way to that. Talking about being determined and setting a goal, I'm going to turn the spotlight on you for just a moment and tell us about your quest, the Northeast 115.
Yes, my husband Adam LaRush and I, we decided, I think about a year, and it's probably been almost just under 2 years, that we wanted to complete, to hike the all 115 of the 4,000-foot peaks in the Northeast. So we've completed the New Hampshire 48. We've completed, obviously, the 5 in Vermont. We have 10 left in New York and 13 left in Maine. I take that back. We have 10 left in the Adirondacks and 2. So anyway, about 27 total. And it has been a blast. I've not ever been one that's, wanted to take on what I was going to say it's a trendy challenge, but it kind of feels that way, or felt that way. But we have just, we have absolutely loved it. We've seen some amazing places. I would encourage anyone that, that had a goal to do that, to get out there and, and explore these amazing mountains. We live in Vermont. So we have, we've got New York to one side and Maine and New Hampshire, to the other. And, it's been spectacular. Spectacular. I've seen things I never would have seen if we hadn't decided to take that plunge.
What a great goal. What a great quest for you and your husband. Congratulations on that. Ruthie LaRush is the sports editor of the St. Albans Messenger. You can read her stories in the Messenger or at samessenger.com. Ruthie, great having you on the program this morning. Thanks so much.
Well, Rick, it's been a pleasure to be here. I appreciate the invitation, and I'm sure, like you, we will both be watching to see how all this unfolds with Tokyo.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, go Ellie. All right, we're going to take a break, and then we'll be back to meet Karen Yakos of Local Motion to discuss bike safety. And Sox, back at it. They're back at Fenway, actually, hosting the Yankees for the first time this season. Our coverage begins tonight at 6:10, play at 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Zingari. Heading out Dorset Street a few weeks ago, it was a sure sign of reemergence from the COVID and the colder months. Cyclists were out and enjoying rides on their bikes. The joy was evident with each pump of the pedals by the bike riders. But it was also a reminder to me that it's a good time to remember how, as a driver of a heavy metal, fast-moving machine, I need to alter my driving. I knew it was time to turn to Karen Yakos, Executive Director of Local Motion, to review how cyclists, motorists, and pedestrians need to behave as we all share the roads and the streets in our state. Karen joins me now to talk about these things. Karen, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, thanks, Rick.
You're welcome. Listeners, to ask Karen a question or share your comments about proper road etiquette for all, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255 is our toll-free number, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Karen, what is Local Motion?
Hi. Well, we're a nonprofit, a statewide nonprofit that supports biking and walking, so we advocate for that. But we do a whole lot of teaching and working with communities, too, to try to make sure it's safe for everybody. So we work in schools. We teach young kids how to bike at all and how to do so safely. We work with adults on how to do that safely on the roads for the first time or because they do it for commuting or whatever. We also are known by some people as the people who run the bike ferry in the Champlain Islands.
Yeah.
We rent bikes on the waterfront, and a big part of what we do is also working with communities across the state on what you're talking about, how to make safe places for people to bike. You need safe places for them to bike, and you need them to know how to bike safely. And to the third point on that, it's you need drivers to know how to behave around that.
That's absolutely the truth. How long has Locomotion been around?
About 20 years. We started with the on the bike path in Burlington. We had a lot to do with that and getting across the Winooski Bridge. And now you can. Now there's obviously if you haven't been to Burlington to do this, this is the summer to do it. But you can bike along the waterfront. You go over the bridge in Winooski to Colchester, and you can go all the way out the Colchester Causeway, take our ferry into the islands, go get ice cream, and then come back.
A long, wonderful trek for ice cream.
It's
right?
it's world class. If your listeners have not been out there, there's nothing like it in the world.
Yeah, is Locomotion government funded? Is it a nonprofit?
We're a nonprofit. We're funded by a lot of different sources. So, donors. We have a great community of donors. We get grants, some from Vermont Transportation, some from others. We also rent bikes on the waterfront, and that. Revenue helps to support the program. It literally is a big chunk of support for the program when
we do. Now, I know you stress the importance of sharing our streets and state roads and back roads safely, but before someone even gets out there on a bike, what are the important steps that they should take?
There are many. We also do training on this, and so there are trainings that you can actually access now online, because with COVID, we turned a lot of this into video.
Yeah.
So there's some great videos on our website for people that are just figuring out how to do this. And right now, you see it on the road. Lots of people have dusted off that old Moto Bacana in the basement and are out biking. And those things will help you sort of make sure that you have the bike that fits you and make sure that it's in good working order. And you can take it to a bike shop and they can get it tuned up for you. And then you can start to learn the rules of the road. And I can talk about some of those here if you'd like, because it's important. We've never seen so many people out biking as we are this year. And like I said, a lot of new people. So it's really important for them to have those skills.
Yeah, I'd love a primer.
Yeah. So, in addition to making sure that your bike is in good working order, brakes work, the shifters work, and all the components are in good shape. You have to understand that you're sharing the road with a lot of others. In the same way I say this to people that drive, too. Everybody has a right to be on that road. And so abiding by certain rules of the road, they're not legislated rules, they're just how we behave on the road, is to really understand the signals. So when you're riding, there are, and these are on our website, but there are things you can do with your hands that tell the motorists around you and the cyclists behind you what you're going to do. Putting your arms up in certain ways. And it's hard to do that on a radio, but
you can
Google it. It's out there. And always being aware of where you are on the road and who's around you, looking for other activity, just like you would if you're in a car. If there's a safe place that's made for biking, it's good to be in that. So sometimes it'll be the side of the road, there'll be a bike lane. That's awesome. We're seeing more and more people doing what your person right before me said. You know, she was up on the Missisquoi Trail. We're seeing more people go on that. So if you're a new rider, you may want to go up to the Lamoille Valley Rail Trail, Missisquoi across Vermont, and just try some of those trails without having to deal with the car traffic around you.
Yeah, that was my next question. If you're not comfortable or confident about riding on those busier city streets or even the country roads, mm-hmm. you know, that's one. Where are some other places that you'd recommend for cyclists?
There's some great rides. On our website, we have a place with maps of some of these rides. And that's another thing is when you're thinking about where you're going to ride, think about your skill level. think about, do you want to be going uphill, steep hill? And if you do, do you want to be doing that with truck traffic? Well, if you don't, go find something that doesn't have that.
Right.
Places I often recommend are, in addition to the off-road offerings that I mentioned just a second ago, up in the islands, there's some great riding. It's St. Albans and Swanton. They've been doing a lot of work to have safe trails that are going to be marked pretty soon. They're putting up some signs. Down in Addison County in the farmland area, just stunning, stunning biking. And those places I just mentioned don't have a lot of car traffic, and they have just great views, and they're relatively flat. So if you don't want relatively flat, there's all kinds of roads and gravel roads around the state. Like I said, we have some of them listed, but there are tons of apps out there where you can see other people's ideas where to go.
And quite often, riders are riding with at least one other person or several other people. So is it acceptable to ride two or more abreast on these roads?
It is, and it's sometimes you'll see some riders do it when they're on a blind curve or something like that, because you really don't want to be stuck. You want to be seen. And same when people walk. You really have to pay attention on those blind curve kind of things. Typically, when you're riding that way, and cars are coming and going, especially in straightaways, it's a good idea to get back in file.
Single file.
And people do, you'll see people doing that.
Yeah. Do you do a lot of biking yourself?
I do. Yeah. Yeah. I just moved to Waterbury from Underhill last year, and I'm looking at an e-bike now.
No kidding.
Because I now I could bike from where I live in Waterbury Center to Stowe up the back way if I could just get up that hill. And I'm at the point in my life where I'm like, yeah, I don't want to go up that hill. So, but an e-bike can make a difference. And by the way, since your folks that listen in are probably from this area as well, we just worked with the town of Stowe on a couple of the groups up there on an e-bike lending library that we run around the state. So these are e-bikes. They're pedal assist bikes. They make a huge difference if you are going long distances or trying to get up hills. You have any sort of disability, you just aren't a strong cyclist, and maybe your partner is. They sort of make everything a tad easier, like you sort of have superpowers, but you're still biking. We take them around to different places, and they just arrived in Stowe at AJ's last week. And you can rent one. You can borrow one. We don't charge for this. You can borrow one for a week, try it out, and see if it changes your life. It usually does, and then you end up getting one.
Oh, I love it.
That's on our website. Probably check with AJ's too. They could all be filled up now because it's real popular, but our website has all the places we're going, and so maybe you're in an area where you could try that this summer.
And I'm not completely sure what an e-bike is. You mentioned there is an assist. So does it have like a motor that can help you in certain spots when you're going up a hill?
It does. And you can buy a bike that's like this, or you can retrofit your own bike for about $1,000 and turn it into one of these. There's a battery. There needs to be an electric motor. And then the mechanics of it are that when you can ride it like a regular bike, you can turn on different levels of assist. You can come use one. Of ours out, but if you start to bike a little, where you're cycling, if you put it on one of the levels, you'll just feel that little extra, like I said, you feel like you're just a little stronger than you thought you were. And you can turn that thing on and off at different levels. And you get a good workout. You're still getting exercise, but you can choose how much exercise. So if you're downtown Burlington and you have to go up to UVM for a meeting, which I have to do sometimes, I'd rather not arrive all sweaty.
Right.
So I'll often borrow one of our e-bikes and I'll go up the hill that way.
I love the idea.
They're awesome. You can also carry a lot of stuff on some of those.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so one of the ones that AJ's has is housing for us is one that's meant to really carry stuff, and your kids.
I love the idea of having it giving me some superpowers, because all my superpowers are gone now, so I could use it. Karen, are there particular traffic rules that people should be aware of when riding a bike in a city or a town with heavy traffic?
Yes. You are more so than when you're on the rural roads, you're going to be in traffic, right?
Right.
And you're going to come to intersections and all that. And you basically ride your bike like you were driving a car. The same rules apply. come to a stop sign, stop, look, all that kind of thing. The other, and use your hand signals as much as possible.
Yeah.
But there is a difference in the sense that, like, in Burlington, for instance, in Rutland and some other places, Montpelier too, you know, a lot of people will take what we call take the lane. They're in the lane of traffic because cars are moving slowly. It's much safer for them to be like a car and sort of interact with the intersections and other cars that way. So it's really on the drivers of the cars to pay attention to on all roads.
Yeah, I asked that, and that a great example. You know, there's a left-hand turn lane, and now a cyclist is going to have to be in that lane in with cars and trucks to make that turn properly, right? And so both of us have to be cognizant of what's going on.
Well, and there's something to say about that, too, that not all cyclists are confident enough to take a lane like that. And so even though that's the best way to do it, and it's the least complicated and probably safe, if you don't feel comfortable doing that, you can always get off your bike, become a pedestrian, get on the sidewalk, cross the streets that way.
Right.
And in some intersections, I'll do that.
Yeah.
I'm more likely to take a lane, but I'm more confident. But you really, there are kind of the rules of the road, but there's also like just common sense.
Right, and safety. All right, it's time to put the pedal under the other foot, and we're going to talk about automobiles, SUVs, truck drivers. What should we be aware of when we're driving on a road and see bike riders up ahead?
Sure. And I was telling you earlier before we got on air that never have we seen so many people cycling.
Yeah.
And so many people that are new to it. And so it's a really good year to understand that the road is made for everyone. You're on your feet, you're on your bike, you're on a skateboard, or in your car. And a car, 2 tons, right?
Right.
3 tons, depending on what it is. And so it's really important to understand that when you're driving, that you have something that could kill somebody. And I drive, right? Not everybody drives. There's some people that don't, but most of us do. And when I am on the road, I'm really thinking about the vulnerable users, the people that are on the side of the road trying to cross the street, the people that are biking. So, and what you can do is you can use common sense, slow down. You're still going to get where you're going. It may take you, 30 seconds longer,
right.
But somebody will have survived your interaction with them. We talked about this earlier off air, but one of the things that everybody has struggles with is you're coming up on a road, not a town road so much, but a rural road, and there's a cyclist or two in front of you in the direction you're going. What do you do? Well, you slow down, mm-hmm. and you look at the situation. You look at how safe they are. If there's a lot of good sight distance, there's nobody coming at you, you can give them a big berth and go around them slowly. In this state, there's a guidance on give them 4 feet. I usually give them as much as I can give them.
Right.
And get well in front of them before you go back into their lane. If it's a turn, and a lot of our roads have big turns, it's really important that people just wait. You know, you don't need to go by that person and squash them into the side of the road. Mm-hmm. Just think about what they're experiencing. And I guarantee you will still get to that thing you're trying to get to on time.
I know it's 30
yeah.
seconds.
I know
sometimes.
It's 30 seconds.
The most.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I'm, thinking, all right, now there's a biker.
Yeah.
And then you think to yourself, you rationalize, 30 seconds, Rick. It's going to take you 30 extra seconds. Nobody at the other end is going to worry that you were 30 seconds here or there, right?
Yeah.
But these cyclists will be concerned if you get too close to them. And you never know the level of the cyclist who you get too close to, right?
Yeah. And I see a lot of bad behavior by people driving cars, but I think a good chunk of that is not intentional. I think people just don't know. And so it's always a good idea to just slow down, assess the situation. Guptill Road here between where we are here and where I live is a common road for people to cycle on, and there's a guy that walks on it every day and other people and dog walking. And so it's a very busy right. road, and I've noticed that people on that road have kind of learned we're going slow through here. Everybody that's out that day or that morning, all those people I just mentioned, they were on the road this morning, they deserved – to be safe. Right. So just slow down, take a look, be careful.
And, you know, it's 2 tons of metal. We're driving it, and, you know, especially we might have just come off the interstate where we're going 65 mm-hmm. miles an hour. So on a excuse me, rural road, going 30 or 35 seems like you're going incredibly slowly
right.
now. But at that speed, and you make contact with a cyclist, what happens?
Yeah, it's not a pretty picture. And speed does matter. There's some graphs out there on the internet that'll show you the difference between going 20 and going 50
yep.
in a crash situation. And it doesn't matter how much gear you have on and how many helmets you have on your head. You know, if you get hit at that speed, it's not, you know, you don't have 2 tons of metal around you.
Right.
So it's just, you know, take your time. It's good for other motorists on the road, too, for just slow down. I mean, I just don't get why we have to feel like we have to drive so fast. But you're right. There's a thing that happens in our head when we get off the interstate. And then we get on here, you know, on Route 100, and then we get off Route 1S. You know, each level seems so much slower, but it's not. And if you want to know what it feels like, go stand in front of your house or somewhere and just feel people go by.
Right.
You know, what does that feel like? How comfortable does that feel?
Yeah. Now, we focused a lot on bikes. We only have a couple minutes left. What should pedestrians be aware of and vehicles around pedestrians?
Yeah, our roads are tough in the state because unless you have a sidewalk, it's really hard to be safe. But we all walk on the roads, and I hate seeing it, but I did it. You know, you push the baby carriage down your little rural road because you got to get out of the house.
Right.
In that case, if there's a sidewalk, be on it. Go to the Lamoille Valley Rail Trail, whatever. If there's not one, you need to walk against traffic. That means traffic is coming at you.
Right.
It's much safer. They will see you. Be aware more than you might normally be that you need to make sure that car sees you. One of the horrible things everywhere is texting while driving or any other distractions. It can take a second for someone to be distracted, and then you're going to get in a crash. So just picking your way through carefully. And picking where, you know, your comfort level and your athleticism and all that, where do you want to be that you could be safe? And if you feel uncomfortable on the road, find a sidewalk, find the Lamoille Valley Rail Trail or the Missisquoi. I always like to say their names because if you haven't been to these places,
yeah.
Go on. And where the Burlington Bike Path is an awesome place.
It really is. We got about a minute. I would love for you to tell us about any other initiatives that Local Motion is working on right now.
Well, I mentioned the e-bike lending library, so I think that's one that should be of interest to people. We are running webinars all year. There's some this summer that help. Like, we just did one for people that community members that want to see how they could do off-road paths. So, you know, probably somebody from the city, town of Waterbury was part of that. So that's one thing. A lot of videos, like you mentioned earlier, we took a lot of our stuff online around safety. So if you're curious about how to do that, look for that. I think, you know, we're pretty much all focused on ferries, the bike ferry and renting bikes and working with communities right now.
Fantastic. Karen Yakos is the executive director of Local Motion. To learn more about their work, you can visit localmotion.org. Karen, so great to have you on the show today.
Thank you so much. Yeah, good timing for getting the word out on
it is, right?
The roads.
All right, we're going to head out for a few minutes, get a CBS News update. After that, we'll hear from national correspondent Bob Day. And a reminder that today at 1 on WDEV, Dr. Lewis Myers will be here with Healthcare Today. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV, and it must be just a few minutes after 10 because we have national correspondent Bob Ney joining us with an update and insights into what's happening in the world. Bob Ney, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
We got Thank Bob? You, Rick.
There's Bob. Hey. All right.
Hey, thank you.
Bob, let's start with the COVID numbers.
Right. We've got numbers and a little bit of analysis, you know, behind it. Mm-hmm. But in the numbers, when it talks about the global numbers, we've got total deaths at 3,884,000 and, you know, 666. And then when you go to the United States, the total deaths are 602,000. And then, of course, it goes into, you know, the cases, 179 million around the world. But I think also, if you look at some statements that the, you know, CDC and the World Health Organization have, you know, made recently, the bottom line is, for the most part, the COVID deaths are in the lowest amount that we've seen since February. So that's the good news, you know. Mm-hmm. The weekly cases dropped to their lowest since February. That's the cases. And but a lot of countries are still struggling. There are some sparse vaccine supplies, the spreads of the variants. We've heard about Delta, et cetera.
Right.
And a lot of these countries, their healthcare system, although ours leveled out, thank goodness, a lot of these countries, they are simply overwhelmed.
Boy, and what will it take? I know a lot of, you know, the U.S. and other countries have agreed to send vaccines to these countries. Is that going to help? Is it happening now yet? What's going on there?
Well, I think it's going to help, but I've been talking particularly to people directly in India, just, you know, to kind of get a handle on what's really going on the ground. And I've talked to people from several parts of India, and I've talked to people that are both educated and uneducated, and I say that for a reason. People that haven't had much education, you know, on the issue, et cetera, they're believing a lot of rumors that 85,000 people have dropped dead after their shot. You know, I'm hearing this from friends up in the, you know, sort of sparse regions. Then some of the people that, you know, have really been paying attention to this, they are not getting their second shot for like 3 months. And India is disputing the United Kingdom study that you should have the second shot within 30 days. So you're seeing some of this also going on, some misinformation and, you know, people's attitudes. And then again, the healthcare systems are just overwhelmed. So it's I think it's a real problem. We've got to come to terms, we the world, because if we don't, it will rear its head in variants. Those will eventually get here, and we will have problems again.
I did find it interesting. Sydney, Australia, is or parts of Sydney, on lockdown. Over 22 cases of coronavirus, and so it's very interesting how some countries react to what we would consider a very small number, even in a state like Vermont.
Right. And of course, you're the highest vaccinated state in the union,
right.
You know, which is great. The other problem I think that is out there is this. I'm not going to blame it all on the CD, but, you know, I went to Florida recently with my, daughter, son-in-law, and grandkids. And I can tell you that 100% of the people in Florida are vaccinated. I can also tell you that 100% of the people in my hometown are vaccinated because nobody wears a mask.
Right.
I say that because once the CDC used the honor system, you know, wear a mask if you're not vaccinated. I don't see anybody hardly with a mask. So, and I know they're not all vaccinated. And I think that that notice from the CDC in itself, let's face it, didn't give a lot of incentive. A lot of people probably would have gotten a shot to just get rid of the mask.
Yeah, good point. What's this mandate that San Francisco has?
Well, now this one's really interesting, Rick, because San Francisco is saying, this is the first major city to do this in America, and it's saying to 35,000 employees, you must get the shot. No choice, you must get the shot. And if they don't, they could be penalized, maybe monetarily, or they could be fired or laid off if they refuse to do it. Now, obviously, there's going to be some lawsuit out of one of the 35,000 people, number one.
Right.
But the other thing that I think we probably don't remember hearing much in this country is that when the vaccines first started, a ruling came out of the commission within the federal government that looks at discrimination, and it made a ruling early on that said you can be fired from your job for not getting a shot, a vaccination, and it's not discrimination. They ruled that way early on, which opened up you know, the ability of companies right now or public governments to say, you get the shot or I'm going to fire you. So it would be tough probably for a person to win a court case. Now, we know, you know, a lot of people haven't been fired because of it because, frankly, a lot of the retail industry, the food industry, the nursing homes couldn't replace people if they had to these days.
True.
So they aren't pushing that envelope except San Francisco now. So we'll see how it goes.
All right. Let's move on to the infrastructure deal. First of all, how and again, it's not completely approved, but the deal that the president and the senators, how did this get done?
Well, on this one, I'm going to try to do this without your listeners snoring over the the airwaves.
Thanks,
because
Bob.
there's a little part to this. Bottom line is that President Biden has cut a deal with Republicans and with a lot of Democrats. Mm-hmm. And I say that because what the Republicans are going for in the infrastructure bill, a lot of the moderate Democrats are fine to be on board with it. So the president's cut a deal. He's announced it. It's a deal on infrastructure. I mean, we could, you know, go over all the parts of it. Bottom line is there's $312 billion in it for transportation, roads and bridges, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. Now, the original bill was in four parts, and it had some money for seniors, it had some money for families, child tax credits, they tied it into transportation. So it had a regular infrastructure part to the original bill and three parts that I'm going to stereotype as, quote, progressive parts, okay?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Just for our discussion, Rick.
Okay.
And basically the president has eliminated some of those, quote, progressive parts of the original bill. They're gone. And he's come up with a bill that doesn't raise taxes or undo the Republican tax decreases from a couple of years ago. And they pay for it, I must say, through a very fascinating structure. You know, with the IRS using unused monies, unused COVID monies, relief monies, you know, et cetera. So they're doing it that way. Strategic petroleum reserves. Now, here's the catch. The progressives are coming unglued.
Right.
They don't like this. They want the whole bill. So, to further confuse the listeners, the Speaker of the House said, okay, when you pass this bill to me, or if you pass this bill to me, this agreed to Biden, Republican, Democrat bill, I won't pass it until you pass reconciliation in the Senate. Reconciliation is a bypass mechanism where they can put all kinds of things in the bill and not have to have 60 votes. You know, they have that cloture, the filibuster, 60 votes instead of 50.
Right.
In reconciliation, they only need 50. So basically what the Speaker is saying to the progressives in the House and Senate, there's your chance. Parts you didn't get in this bill, put it in reconciliation. Once reconciliation passes, then I'll pass transportation. Now, here's the bottom line, though. The Speaker's not saying everything you want, I'm going to guarantee that in reconciliation. She's just saying, I want a reconciliation vote.
And some of the
things, they may get part of what they want, and they may not.
And some of the things that she's pushing for are like child care, for instance, that wouldn't be, you know, hard infrastructure items, correct?
Right. Right. And but what she's doing is saving the infrastructure bill, because if she didn't do this, the progressives would, you know, basically freak out. And then they would probably try to down the bill. This way she's saying, you didn't get what you want. I'm doing this in layman's terms. She
right.
didn't say this, actually. But the speaker's saying, basically, in other words, you didn't get what you want, but hey, you're going to get your shot in reconciliation. Take your shot there. Don't down this bill.
I heard sound bites, Bob, from both Republicans, Democrats, and very progressive Democrats, all saying that they didn't get what they wanted. So when that happens, is that a good thing? And everybody will join hands agreeing that, hey, we didn't get what we wanted. Nobody did, but for the good of the country. Or is this, you know, a situation where the wheels fall off because nobody got what they wanted?
Well, I'm going to handicap this at 70 to 75%. It'll pass. I'm not going 80, 90, 95. I'm going to say 70 or 75%. There are a few wheels that can fall off here.
Mm-hmm.
The speaker's trying to save it by saying, go after what you want in reconciliation. Wonder if they don't get all what they want. You know, it's hard to say. I've done this, to be honest with you, Rick, myself, where I take something out of a bill, and a member, you know, who's maybe a powerful member, freaks out over it, and they come to me, and I'm going to take your bill down. And I say, okay, I'll tell you what. I'll support you trying to get an amendment in another bill. And 9 out of 10 times they'll do that. And if they don't get their amendment in another bill, then they have to choose whether to try to, you know, retaliate and bring a bill down. So that's what the speaker's done with this, and but I'm only going to put it at 70 or 75, which is high, but I'm not going to go up into the 90s because this is a little bit delicate right now.
And Bob, very quickly, the way that this got done with Democrats, Republicans coming together, even though it was a small portion of the Senate, positive for you know what could happen going forward over the next at least year and a half with Congress to get things done with President Joe Biden?
Well, you know, I used to always say if, you know, both sides are a little upset with the bill, it must be good.
You got it.
And, you know, and President Biden, this is a win for him, Rick. No question about it. This is a big win for the White House. But I think it's also a win for the system, especially the Senate, which is, you know, the tougher place. But I still think it's a win. The fact they could come together on something major like this is hopefully, you know, a starting point. They won't win on some other things coming together, but hopefully this is, and let me put it this way, if they can't come together on this, they're not going to be able to come together on anything. This is a mom and apple pie.
Yeah, I mean, it sure is.
Your members are going to come home and say, oh, I just built that highway, you know, we just did this. It's a mom and apple pie.
Nobody hates infrastructure. National correspondent Bob Day, thanks for spending the time with us again this week. Always great
Thank
to talk
you,
to
Rick.
You. All right. It is 10:20, and I don't know if we got our wires crossed, or it could possibly be that Kevin McCallum of 7 Days got called out on a story, and those things happen. And so we were going to be talking about a great piece he's written this week in 7 Days. You can find it in the new issue of 7 Days. You can go to 7daysvt.com and read all about it. First of all, the entire issue of 7 Days really is dedicated to bees and honey, and it's a great addition. A lot of things you'll learn about. But we were going to talk about how seeds that are treated with pesticides are affecting or could be affecting the health of our hives. And hoping that Kevin still has a chance to call in. But if not, listeners, here's an opportunity. You got about 10 minutes to take over. Open phones till 10:30. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. And we can talk about whatever you'd like. I tried to find the gentleman's name. I had to cut him off on, I think, Monday. He called in when it's the only time we've had open phones this week, and he called just at the end, and he wanted to talk about rail. I think I had mentioned, you know, it had been Father's Day if you wanted to honor your father, and I think he was calling to tell a story of how his father used to take him to some place in New York State to see trains, and it sounded like a fascinating place. So if he's listening and would like to call now, now's a good time, and not in like 5 or 6 minutes as we head to the next break. But again, our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. And I don't have any real topics to throw out to you, so it's a wide open phones for the next 5-6 minutes. And if you don't call, then I'm in trouble because I'm going to have to really rant for a while. I have a little bit of a frog today. I was out last night. Friends were in from Ohio. It was really great. Family were here, and it was wonderful to hear about their experiences in Vermont and New Hampshire this week, places I know and love, some places I've not been to, but they lit up, husband, wife, and two daughters, I think like age 8 and 10. And the beaches, Shelburne Museum. They were over to Littleton, New Hampshire. And I didn't know this, but I think there's the world's largest candy counter in Littleton, New Hampshire. So there's another place on my list that I've got to get to now that we're able to get around. But anyway, last night it was one of those weekly music outings that are occurring again, and so I was up in South Hero to Snow Farm Winery, and I've known people who have gone. I've been out to Snow Farm, but never for their Thursday night concerts, and it was packed. It's the most Vermonters or the people I've seen in a space at least a year and a half, maybe longer. It was really incredible to be around people and seeing smiles and dancing, singing. It was really pretty wonderful. So proud of Vermont that we've stepped up, we've rolled up those sleeves, taken the vaccine, now over 81%, and the knock-on effect is this is what it allows. This is what it was all about. You do your part, you get vaccinated, and we become a place where we can once again go out, see each other, be with each other. And here's the important thing, and I don't think people realize this, the importance of that family in Ohio knowing that Vermont was doing the right thing, that our numbers were low as far as cases, and that our vaccination rate was high. And so they had no problem at all saying, we want to go somewhere this summer. We're going to Vermont because they're at now over 80% vaccinated. It makes a difference, and that brings people here to Vermont. We know how much we rely on tourism, and that sustains us, all right? It's a small state. We know that, 630-some thousand people. And if we can't bring people from elsewhere to Vermont, we've already lost our great Canadian friends, and hopefully that will happen again. I know they're jonesing to get down here as much as we are to get up to Quebec. But, you have people in other parts of the country who look at, where's it safe? Vermont. Let's go there. So I have my sister and brother-in-law in a couple weeks coming, and I have another student I taught at Miami University who will be coming to visit in the fall. And the fact that we have done the right thing, the fact that we have gotten vaccinated at the rate we have, has made a difference to these people and to others, and who now feel safe coming to visit us. So if you haven't gotten vaccinated, I'm not preaching. You make your own decision, and I absolutely support what you do, because everyone has to live with the decision they make. I totally get that. You know what my decision is. I'm not, going to hide it, but I'm also not going to preach to anyone that my decision has to be your decision. But I do ask you, look at the science and look at the effect of what this does for our communities, what it does for our state, as you make that decision. We heard from the governor the other day. I know he couldn't be prouder of what Vermonters have done, but you really have to hand it to his administration. You have to hand it to the Department of Health. And we're going to hear today at 1 o'clock from Dr. Mark Levine, Health Commissioner. What a superstar Dr. Levine has been through all this. He has had to digest the science for us, right? When it comes to what COVID is, what, measures we should all be taking. And then this vaccine, right? Or several of them. And again, he has to understand it for all of us. He's got to review it. He's got to digest it. He's got to make decisions. And he did. And, you know, he stood up there three times a week, then two times a week, and still once a week to let us know what he has determined. And it was that these are safe and these are what we need to do. And Vermonters, you listened. You behaved. You wore masks. You socially distanced. You stayed in as much as possible. And now that it's safe for us because we've got to over 81% of the state vaccinated, which is an incredible number. And we can go higher. You know, the more we do, you know, the safer it is. Just remember, if you're not vaccinated, and again, I don't know the science of it, but you're in a small pool now of people who can get COVID. And I don't know that you want that, especially you hear people who have had it and share their experiences, and it's not pleasant, and they wish they had been vaccinated. But again, I'm not preaching. It is for you to make your own decision, and there's a lot of things that go into that. All right, unfortunately, Kevin McCallum, not able to join us, and that's all right. Kevin, a great journalist, the political reporter for 7 days. Always enjoy having him on. I hope we can get him on again soon. Maybe we can reschedule this interview with Kevin. You can read his story, and it's very interesting. And the whole, like I said, the whole issue of 7 days dedicated to bees and that whole industry in the state. Kevin's story, 7 days this week's, or online, 7daysvt.com. So take opportunity to read what he's written. We're going to take a break and then be back to wander around one of Vermont's most beautiful libraries, Kellogg Hubbard Library in Montpelier. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. For whatever reason, maybe it's what's going on in your life or the catalog of things being offered there, but certain libraries have played a larger role than others in your life and in my life. No doubt for me, the Bethlehem Public Library as I was growing up, the University of Dayton, St. Thomas University Libraries during my undergrad and grad school days, and the Kellogg Hubbard Library when I lived in Montpelier. They were places I was comfortable browsing around, spending time hunkered down in, looking for books, audiobooks, DVDs, that would keep me company. Over these past several months of hosting Vermont Viewpoint, I've enjoyed taking you to several of Vermont's libraries, and today, Kellogg Hubbard gets the spotlight. Here to tell us what's going on there is the library co-director, Carolyn Brennan. Carolyn, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. Listeners, if you've got a question for Carolyn or you want to share how they you've used the Kellogg Hubbard Library, you can join us by calling 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Carolyn, the library has a colorful history. How did it get started?
Sure. So the library was established in 1896, but its history began 7 years earlier. So Martin Kellogg died. He was he made his fortune in real estate in New York City, but he'd been born in Barrie, and then his death was followed shortly thereafter by his wife Fanny. So Martin had left his $300,000 estate to Fanny, but then Fanny left it to the city of Montpelier in part to build and maintain a library. So their nephew, John Hubbard, who lived in Montpelier, contested his aunt's will. He won, and then he was sued by the city of Montpelier. So ultimately, John agreed to build a library, but at the significantly reduced cost of $60,000 at that time. And it was, he became this kind of persona non grata, and he was reviled by Thomas Waterman Wood, who founded the T.W. Wood Art Gallery. The gallery was founded in direct and vocal protest to John's perceived stinginess. And he has this, now he has this famous funerary monument over at Green Mountain Cemetery, the archway to the cemetery, which his money ultimately helped build also. And that monument is called Black Agnes, and it has its own place in urban legend in the city of Montpelier.
Well, Carolyn, weathering this pandemic seems like, as the Brits say, small beers for Kellogg Hubbard. What are some of the other major challenges that the library has made it through?
Sure. So the library was closed for a good part of the summer and fall of 1917 because of a polio outbreak in the city of Montpelier. So at that point, this is going to all sound very familiar now, but there were citywide restrictions put in place. There were quarantines in effect, and those weren't lifted until October of that year. So the library remained closed off and on for a good portion of 1917. And then a year later, in the fall of 1918, the Spanish flu hit the city of Montpelier, and the library basement was put into use as the headquarters of the Relief Committee for the Spanish flu. And we also hosted, this is terribly morbid, but we hosted a nursery for the children of the sick and the dead during the Spanish flu. So we also have been through World War One and World War Two. In World War One, the library participated in an initiative by the American Library Association where we collected and sent books to troops serving on the front lines. And in World War Two, we were the Vermont District Warning Center. And my World War II history is a little bit lacking, but I believe that these district warning centers were meant to coordinate civilian defense if the war ever reached American shores. And we have this wonderful letter from the Vermont Council of Safety in 1944 thanking us for maintaining the center and saying staffed 24/7 by a team of 150 volunteers and the public will never know the sacrifice that the trustees and the librarians made. It's this kind of wonderful, this wonderful thank you that we have on file. And then, of course, flooding. In the flood of 27, the library flooded to about 5 feet up on the first floor of the library. We have on the column next to our main desk, we have the high watermark for that event. And then in the ice dams in 1992, when the Winooski flooded, that flooded to the ceiling of our basement and destroyed the children's library. So we've had, over our 125-year history, a number of major events that we have recovered and sprung back from, and in many cases sprung back better and stronger than we were previously.
Well, Carolyn, it is one of the most stunning libraries I have ever been in. What can you tell us about the building itself?
Sure. So the building, it's made of almost entirely local materials, the original building. So the exterior is Dummerston granite, and the walls are 2 feet thick. And my co-director, Jesse Lynn, has told me, that she's drilled through those walls exactly twice since she's in the more than a decade that she's been here, because doing so is no mean feat.
Right.
And we're the interior. We have this glorious courtesan oak. We have beautiful wainscoting and this 10-foot-tall fireplace that's made out of Rutland marble. The columns in the front, I love the materials. I love the sort of, with the local war movement. I love talking about how, everything kind of came from here to build this fantastic edifice. Our columns in the front are pink granite from North Conway, New Hampshire. I think the material that came from the farthest field building the building was lining our front porch. We have this, it's called Tennessee marble. And it's not a true marble. I don't remember what the stone actually is, but in the right humid conditions, it becomes this sort of beautiful mauve color. It's just wonderful. It's a phenomenal, phenomenal building that we have.
Are there any additions or changes planned right now?
Yeah, sure. So, of course, the largest addition that was put on the library was put on about 20 years ago, and that moved our children's library out of the basement and put it in the upstairs, and it built a nonfiction wing and gave us new meeting space. And so that was an incredible construction project. My office that I'm sitting in right now is in that addition. And then at the end of the tail end of 2019, right before the beginning of the pandemic, we finished a capital funding campaign, the first capital funding campaign that we had done in a number of years, and it was very successful. And so that was called the Give the Library a Lift campaign, and the lift is our elevator. So we have had our elevator completely rebuilt. We have redone the exterior woodwork, and we have rebuilt the windows in the historic part of the building, which are engineered in this kind of incredible way. So these giant windows that go completely up and recede into the walls of the building, which is not something that you would find in modern construction.
Not at all.
And we've got a number of, we did heating upgrades, and we have a number of projects still coming up, and that as a result of that capital campaign. So we're having all of our carpeting replaced, and we are getting our interior woodwork restoration done, and we just got our building repointed. We have a front step to rebuild. So there's a tremendous number of projects that we've already completed and that are on the table for completion right now.
And before we get to the programs you have going on there at Kellogg Hubbard, you also have a famous library member who started going there as a kid long before he became a long-serving U.S. senator.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, Senator Patrick Leahy. He tells a wonderful story about coming in here as a child and his experience with the children's librarian that was there at that time. And she would give him, you know, all of the books that he kind of wasn't supposed to read, or let him check out things that were maybe others would have considered a little grown up. And so he has had a lifelong relationship with the library. So we very famously get the residuals from his appearances in the Dark Knight Batman movie series that he appeared in. We have this wonderful plaque in our children's library that says, thank you to our, it thanks the senator for not being intimidated by thugs, which is like the line that he says to the Joker in Batman Begins. And so he stops by periodically. And it's always wonderful to have the senator in the library. He tells wonderful, wonderful stories, and he's been involved in a number of programs and initiatives with us for ages at this point, for a very long time.
A great supporter of Kellogg Hubbard. Freshman year in college, I had a cool work-study gig. I worked in acquisitions of the law library. Not only did I get really proficient using the date stamper, but I was also right there in the library, so afterwards I could stick around for an hour or two, do some homework before heading back to the dorm. In grad school, I didn't need a special excuse to find the library. I lived there. These buildings that contain books for use to read, to research, to recline with, are an amazing source of knowledge and a community center point. Today, we're visiting Montpelier's Kellogg Hubbard Library with co-director Carolyn Brennan. If you'd like to hop into the conversation, our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Carolyn, let's talk about programs you have for young readers this summer.
Yeah, so we're right. We've just started about a week ago our summer reading program. So the theme for the summer reading program is Tales and Tales. So there is an animal component.
Spelled two different ways.
Spelled two different ways, indeed. And so we have a reading challenge component. So area children can sign up for the summer reading challenge through our website, and they pick a reading goal, and then there's a variety of incentives to keep them reading all summer long. And then program-wise, we have storytelling and events in all of our member towns. So the KHL supports six communities, so Montpelier and five outlying towns. And So our children's librarian is going to go hold events in all of our member towns. And we have a dog. We're partnering with the local Humane Society to have like a dog agility trial on our lawn in July, which particularly looking forward to. It's going to be very cool. And we have a program coming up called What Does That Wagging Tail Really Say?, which is a way to introduce children to the body language of dogs and of animals. And then we have, right now, as I was walking in the building this morning, I walked right through the middle of Shakespeare Camp. So we have two day camps going on this summer that we've been doing for a number of years. Our one of our youth services librarians, Nicole Westbaum, offers this wonderful Shakespeare camp where the kids, they get together and they rehearse the script and they create all their costumes and scenery. And then at the end of the week, they host a performance. And so we weren't able to do that, or we did it in a video collaborative distanced way last summer. So this summer, it's just wonderful to see that group meeting outside and being able to meet. And the kids get so excited. It always we always end up waitlisting some of these programs where there's actual individual signups.
Wow, so brilliant. All right. Now, I think for the summer, these are taking a break, but let's talk about the lecture series you have with the League of Women Voters and Vermont Humanities.
Yeah, so every year we are a host site for the Vermont Humanities Council for their First Wednesdays program. So that is this wonderful lecture series that brings in kind of national level experts on a variety of topics. And one of the places, they have nine locations around the state of Vermont, and one of the locations is the Kellogg Hubbard. And so on the first Wednesday of the month from October through May, we host these just wonderful free lectures. And the League of Women Voters is similar. They pick a theme. Sometimes it is their justice-related themes. We had one, we had a series on policing, community policing recently, and again we have these panels of local experts. It's always really timely, really topical, really interesting stuff, and it's a wonderful opportunity for people to get together. I mean, that's one of the great wonderful things about the library, is that and people that you might not otherwise meet. You can get together over shared interest in a topic and then kind of continue these conversations, continue conversations after the program is long over. So we had a program, a number of our adult programs are recorded on our website. You can go back and watch the videos of them. One of the things that kind of came out of the pandemic, we had to switch to digital programming through Zoom, and we're all feeling a little zoomed out at this point, I think. But we were able to record a lot of those programs. And so over the summer, when our adult programming is on hiatus, you can get on our website and you can watch videos of where are all the great women artists. We had a midday meditation reset, and those videos are on there. Policing and juvenile justice, policing and mental health, and just wonderful, wonderful, interesting topics.
Kellogg Hubbard has recently instituted a fine-free program. Tell us about how that works.
Yeah, so I'm very, very excited about this. In its 125-year history, this is the first time that the library has abandoned the practice of charging overdue fees for library material. So our trustees voted this change into place in May, and so we're still requiring that people return their books on time or renew their books, and there's limits to how long you can keep an item out. But as long as you return the items to the library and they're in good condition, you're not going to be charged an overdue fine. So the issue with library fines is that they typically disproportionately affect people with lower incomes or people that can't access the library independently, like children or people who live farther away from the library or people who don't have reliable transportation. So they create what's called an economic barrier to access for an institution that is meant to be free to all. And so this is a really big deal. And the library has relied at least partially on fine income throughout its history. But we have been working in the past several years to reduce our reliance on fine income. We have a year-round book sale that we have as a fundraiser. We're encouraging donors to participate in monthly giving at the library, and that helps us have a steady, reliable income so we can reduce our reliance on fines. And then we also have, for this coming fiscal year that's going to start on July 1st, a number of business sponsors that have agreed to help support us to maintain this initiative. So Hunger Mountain Co-op is our underwriter for this year, but it's an ongoing effort. So we need to, there is definitely an income component that we need help to replace. But in terms of the library's mission, this is a incredibly mission-centric and worthwhile move for us to make.
Is there an amnesty for books that have been out for a while? I don't know if you're a Seinfeld fan, but I'm thinking of Jerry and Tropic of Cancer that he had not returned for a number of years. But will people be able to bring back books that without a fine that they've had for a while?
Yes, absolutely. But there was an article, a few years ago now, that a similar thing happened at Fletcher Free Library in Burlington, where somebody returned something that was due in like the 1950s. And if they were truly charged, the fine was like in the thousands.
Right.
So yes, there absolutely is amnesty in place. We're working through we're waiving all of our existing fines. So for things that were already returned, but had been returned late and there were fines kind of still hanging out on patron accounts, we're going through and waiving all of those, and they'll all be waived by July 1st. And if somebody were to bring something back overdue now, we would not charge them a fine, as long as we can turn around and continue to circulate that item. I should put in the caveat of sometimes, somebody drops their book in the tub, or they, their dog eats it, which has actually happened, and so in those cases, if something's brought back and it's utterly destroyed and we really can't lend it out to anybody else, then we do charge replacement.
I think that's fair. Carolyn Brennan said to me that she could talk all day about the Kellogg Hubbard Library. Unfortunately, we don't have all day. We're out of time, but it was really delightful. Carolyn Brennan is the co-director of the Kellogg Hubbard Library in Montpelier. The website is KelloggHubbard.org. Carolyn, so great to visit with you today. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you again so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. All right, that is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan and is produced by Rachel Connor, Zoe Helena, and Willow Zartarian. Our email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free, suggest topics, guests, love to hear from you. You can also listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. We've got Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio, up next. This is Rick Singeri, and I will meet you back here on Monday.